Briefly, I'll introduce myself. I joined Marty Lafferty about 3 months ago. My background is the media entertainment industry, and I'm going to be helping DCIA bring on cloud computing developers that are going to be focused on the entertainment industry. So any of you in the audience, if you would like to approach me during lunch or during the cocktail hour and give me specific information on what you're doing and see if I can help you get in front of some of the major distributors like Comcast and Time Warner and also the cable TV networks we're going to be focusing on as well. So we've already met all the gentlemen up here. Why don't you briefly just say your names?
Sure. Sal Vella.
Again.
I'm Larry Friedman.
I'm Hashi Bai.
And I'm Wes Carberry.
Thank you, gentlemen. Our mid-morning panel is comprised of executives representing two major technology sector brands, both of which are now also leading cloud service providers, a very accomplished industry consultant, and a major global law firm partner who practices focus on cloud computing. We've already met each one of them, so let's begin with a question. Earlier, we briefly touched on DevOps, the software development methodology emphasizing communication, collaboration, and integration among software developers and IT operations personnel. Isn't DevOps just sound project management? Ensuring that involved stakeholders stay in close contact so that work is done efficiently. Is there more to DevOps than this? How do you define the term? Hashi, let's start with you on this.
Okay, I touched on this in my talk. In my mind, the DevOps is all about to make the software life cycle to run as fast and as efficient as possible. So what we'd like to see is to eliminate unnecessary conflicts, frictions, and the wastes, because that's what slows business down. And if we can free people from those frictions, we can refocus on more innovations and learnings. A healthy product line is actually a learning experience, which means you present your product to your customer as quickly as possible, and you learn as much as possible from your customers. I think that's what DevOps is about, is to turning the software development cycle into a learning cycle. Yeah.
Sal, do you
want to
answer?
Sure, yeah. One of the, so we define it as the end-to-end process. We did a report that Forrester did. They interviewed 600 companies around the world, and some of the findings are really interesting. One of them is that they looked at how fast people could produce software, and what they found was a team that's doing waterfall can't get past 1 to 2 months. They can occasionally deliver in 1 to 2 months, but they can't on a consistent basis. Okay, so just the I work in analogies. My father, when we were growing up, made wine, right? So in the fall, it was fermenting wine in the garage. Okay, that's what we would have. And the way you make wine is you get the grapes, you crush them, and then you press down on them, right? And you press as much as you can. You get this whole giant press. But there's just so much that will give you. It won't get you all the juices. After a while, you have to take the thing apart, reconfigure, and you get a whole lot more juice, right? So same thing here, right? Just simply trying harder with waterfall won't work. You have to actually buy into DevOps, and that's the end-to-end process, looking for waste across that whole set. And time again, the waste that we find is in planning, and I talked about the financial services example, right? Planning is done awfully. Testing, way too much testing is still manual. And deployment of software into environments for test and into environments for production is done abysmally, okay, across the industry. One of the things that we've got actually is it's a self-assessment. It's available on the web. Anyone can take it. We released it in June. We've had 1,000 clients take it. We've got 200, you know, IBM internal teams take it, and the results are pretty consistent in terms of where we fail as an industry, in terms of all of us. You know, I like to say that with software development, we're all sinners, right? I mean, I manage a software development team. We have 42,000 developers in IBM, and see things in the industry. We're all sinners to some degree, right? All have things that we can do much better.
Wes, do you want to contribute?
Sure, I just add a bit of an anecdote to that. I mean, because I agree with what Sal and Haishi are saying. But you know, I think just we look at DevOps as it's not just the process with which you're running the project, but it's really the experience and the deep understanding of technology. And so, you know, choosing the right technology is a very critical part of the process that sometimes predates the actual project itself.
Larry.
Yeah, I'll be really brief. I think DevOps could be part of the true value proposition for cloud on a going forward basis. I think in terms of one of the lures to companies who might want to migrate or adopt to the cloud, the customized services and the ability to not only access technology that's not readily available where they are, but to even create or customize that technology to their situation is huge. And cloud can be a huge enabler if you combine DevOps on top of the cloud. So I see it as a real value add for the cloud.
Following up, based upon the definition of DevOps that you provided, what is the best example you can cite of DevOps being successfully employed by an entity to date? How did it improve the performance of the organization involved in that? Let's start with you, Sal.
Sure. So this is the IBM story. So IBM as sinners, right? We have 42,000 developers within Software Group. Last year, we looked and said, how long does it take us to release software on average across Software Group? We have, you know, thousands of products. The average is 18 months. Was 18 months 4 years ago, was 18 months last year, right? And so we call this a maladaptation, right? What might have been good 4 years ago, the 18 months, now with requirements such as putting things onto Bluemix, what we need to do, 18 months isn't good enough. So we had to change. We put together a program to transform ourselves across Software Group, across these 42,000 people. And frankly, we thought that we were quite well prepared to do it top down, to rate teams, rank teams, and force people to go do this, right? So across the teams, we got evangelists, implementation managers, and then we held the first, we put an announcement that we were gonna go do this, or just an announcement of a conference call to kick this off. Just, you know, just one of your spam emails that, you know, could normally just hit delete. We had 10,000 people sign up, right? 10,000 people joined the call. We had to turn a bunch away. So that was huge, right? To me, that was a sign that there was a pent-up need that people, I think one of the, Heshi may have talked about just the fact that the team knows, right? The team knows where they are, and we just need the permission to go improve themselves. So now we have a vibrant set of community. We have a little, you know, center of competency, about 8 people, and every brand is off improving how they do what they do. And things like the firmware, right? Things that used to take 2 months of update cycles now happen within hours. On my team, you know, deployments that, you know, 5 years ago took 5 days into production now take 20 minutes. And we're working on, you know, zero downtime deployments of our software. We've got some teams, because it depends on the needs, some teams that are deploying hundreds of times a day into production, right? So it's been incredible to see the fact that if you give the encouragement, give people the seed, the improvements that can happen, and some amount of infrastructure. So that's been very good.
Wow. Wes?
Yeah, I would probably talk to Bridget, the application we just discussed, and again, you know, briefly adding on to it, how we extended the engagement and frankly the feedback loop to the customers and to the students in this case, where students and counselors had the ability to contribute via the platform as to improvements that need to be made to the actual application itself, which were then able to be very quickly integrated into that. And so in my mind, that showed very successful, because I had to appreciate when in Sal's presentation, as he was talking about or actually even just recently with your first answer, where you just can't get waterfall to go down below 2 months. So how do you respond to that feedback faster?
So, you know, Larry, would you like to add to their comments?
Just that in terms of examples, we have a client that has developed a very sophisticated insurance claims processing software and technology and sort of modality. And they're a client of ours because we work a lot in the insurance and reinsurance business. And they've found that hugely successful to kind of deploy that through the cloud to multiple customers around the world who are realizing that they can get the sophistication of a Boston-based company taking this to the highest level without making those investments locally. So that's the best example I can give you.
Hi, Shi.
Yeah, I think I talk about this during my talk. I will talk about the Azure itself. Basically, Microsoft is a very large organization with many teams. What we did in Azure is that we are encouraging teams to find out what's the best ways that work for them. Of course, there are general guidelines and principles got imposed on all the developers. There has to be some quality criteria you have to meet. But in terms of how you do your job, let's just take the source control, right? Internally, we have Git repository, we have Visual Studio Online repositories, and in terms of languages, for instance, many of the services are written in C#, but for instance, the mobile service is actually written in Node.js. So you can see the teams are having those flexibilities and to choose the tools that they like and that they are comfortable with, and that's how we can reduce our release cycle from months to weeks. Basically, we have new releases every week of all kinds of Azure services.
Okay, and now the flip side, if you will. Where is DevOps not doing well? Or if you choose not to point to a failure, where would you anticipate that DevOps would not be a good idea to attempt? Let's start with you, Wes, this time.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm going to fall back on consulting speak here, but you know, if we're looking at everything from a people, process, and technology perspective, let's assume, as part of our previous conversations about this, that we've chosen technology appropriately. DevOps is a great maturation of the processes around how we're approaching projects, and really, it pushes us towards, and it's a positive step forward on engaging all the stakeholders and creating a successful project. But where it doesn't work sometimes is frankly when you get to the people. And there are, and we have seen some organizations that don't want to change, and it requires a lot of organizational flexibility and collaboration. So in organizations that are very siloed, you'll run into challenges, and frankly, you get a lot of, well, this is the way we've always done things. And that's sort of a red flag that'll pop up and say, well, maybe we need to dig in deeper, and it may require a little bit more change management before we approach it with DevOps.
Larry.
Yeah, my comment was very similar to Wes's, couched in a different perspective, which is there can be a gap sometimes between the best laid plans and the ideas that a provider can offer versus the ultimate customer and their ability to digest and use. And that goes to even the basic language of the conversation. So the technical people need to be able to translate what they're saying so that the business people, and not even the C-level people, but the below C-level people who have to make this stuff work, understand it and get it and are behind it. And you know, when you say you know, that would be a red flag in a company, I would agree, but the people working in that company who might be very smart, dedicated people who get high performance ratings will say that's not a red flag. That's yeah. Our reality.
Yeah.
And all of the extra benefits that may be attendant to this are no good to us if we can't meet in the middle on what our reality is. So it's just, in short, a very pragmatic roll up your sleeves implementation challenge.
Hi, Shi.
Actually, for this, I'd like to tell a story that happened within Microsoft. So once we have an internal meeting, we have about 3,000 developers in the meeting. And the speaker asked the question, how many of you are using Windows Phone? And every single of us had a Windows Phone, of course. And the point of the speaker is that for the DevOps to work, not only you need to make the life cycle run faster, but also you need to really incorporate the learning process into your production life cycle. Meaning you need to ask the right question, you need to collect the correct data. Because when you move faster, and if you feel you're moving at the wrong direction, that means you're making bigger mistakes. So I think it's a critical piece for DevOps that to incorporate constant learning with the customer so that you can keep improving process as well as satisfying the customers at the same time.
Yeah. Sal, do you want to add anything to this?
Sure. So I agree with everything that the panelists have said. One of the things that, so within Irrational, we have two sides. We have tools for the IT side, but we also have tools for systems engineers, people who, you know, the Boeings, Lockheeds, Raytheons, and many, many others who build products. And so one of the things that we've been working on is how does DevOps translate to that world? Because it's not the same, right? It's not that you're going to build a plane 1,000 times a day. Like you could, you know, push out a build 1,000 times a day. But what could we do there? And even there, you know, the same principles apply about waste. The same principles apply about feedback, but in a different way. And so what we're looking there is, you know, if we can model the asset, the physical asset, and we can simulate it, then we have an opportunity to do the same kind of speed or get speed advantages there, much like what happens in the pure software world. So that's kind of an interesting twist that we're evolving. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Mobile cloud is certainly a huge trend in the cloud computing industry. Even my 75-year-old mother understands it somewhat. It is affecting a lot of sectors of the economy in different ways. We're hearing about enormous impacts ranging from bring your own device phenomenon to the Internet of Things. How do you define the term mobile cloud? And how is it different from cloud computing that is not mobile? Let's start with you, Larry.
I think, again, I would largely defer to my co-panelists to give sort of the detailed answer to this. From the perspective I have, which is working with providers and customers of cloud computing, and in terms of the kind of non-technical perspective of what they think about as mobile cloud, I think it's that not so much that the cloud itself is mobile, but rather that the cloud enables mobility in their business. And that is a critical thing. And it's almost surprising to me, given all of us with our devices, I think the statistics are now there are more devices in the United States than human beings. I think we've crossed that threshold. So it's a mobile society. It's sort of old news that fast-acting information and portable information helps businesses win and succeed. So it's all about the value and the ability of the cloud to provision that mobility. So I don't think of it as the mobile cloud. I think of it as the cloud making mobility happen.
Interesting. Hi, Shi.
In my mind, mobile cloud is about ubiquitous cloud, meaning that the devices and cloud, they complement each other. And on one hand, the cloud can orchestrate a large number of devices and provide highly available services. But on the other hand, the devices can make cloud relevant to local context. And when we talk about devices, I don't think we should constrain ourselves to the mobile phones and tablets. We also look at the wearable devices or sensors that we deploy across the industry. For instance, if you have a temperature sensor deployed in a room, it just gives you a number. It doesn't mean anything. But if you can collaboratively analyze the data from 1,000 sensors, you can analyze the pattern and trend and get additional intelligence out of it. So I think the cloud and the mobile, they really complement each other. And at the end, what mobile provides to the cloud is the reach, the broader reach of the cloud service. And the cloud be able to collaborate across multiple devices. I think that's how they work together.
Sal?
So, just adding to what's been said, I see it in two ways. One, the ability to be able to create applications quickly, and you've seen examples of how to do that dramatically faster than before, and be able to do that experimentation. And that, go experience it yourself, right? Because it is very powerful. But the other one is the ubiquity, right? It is about being able to do things that you couldn't do before. If you wanted to set up a terabyte or a 100 terabyte data warehouse or a Hadoop system on your own, think about how long that would take you in your enterprise to put in the hardware requests, get the hardware provision, maybe get a DBA that's interested in helping you solve your problems. I can make fun of DBAs. I spent many times in that world. But it takes a heck of a long time. In this world, you can provision all the hard stuff for you, and for you as a user, all the hard stuff's left to the producer of it, be it in Azure, be it in Bluemix. That's all in the background. What you get to do is you get to enjoy the benefits and provide it to whatever use you want, right? And much of that is mobile, but I think mobile is just it's an adjective, no longer a noun on its own.
Wes?
Yeah, I may be taking a little bit of a different spin to this, but I look at mobile cloud as really enabling the offloading of more complex computing from the lower power devices that you get. And so, I think the first step is how, we've taken that from a mobile perspective, but you can see where it's going to grow as we move into the Internet of Things, where you have all the complex computing just sending simple visualization or simple commands to the thing that's in the Internet of Things device.
So following up, based upon the definition of mobile cloud that you provided, what is the best example you can cite of mobile cloud being successfully employed by an entity to date? And how did it improve the performance of the organization involved in that? Haishi, first this time.
Actually, I don't have a good use case, I think I can mention one of the cloud and the device combinations. This is essentially this company. They deployed a solution that have basically acoustic sensors across the city, and these sensors coordinate over the cloud and to detect gunshots. And when they detect gunshots, they can send the notifications directly to 911 centers. So the response time from the response time to a gunshot event can be reduced to merely like 10 seconds or 15 seconds. I think that's quite significant in terms of public safety.
Okay. Yeah. Sal?
Sure. My example will be one within IBM of mobile device management. So we acquired a company called FiberLink. It's a software as a service, Mass 360. And prior to that, we had maybe a hodgepodge of solutions. You could sort of get your device on the network, not good, but you could, violate the CIO rules. We had a separate app store, so you had to kind of hunt and find the right magic word to get the app store. That's been, we acquired the company not that long ago, and magically, it's on this device, it's on everybody's phone, and it's gone flawless. All of a sudden, all of those enterprise applications that you had to kind of have a magic word to go find where it was are pushed out to you, right? So that's been a really transformative one of just something happening ubiquitously and no issue at the scale where we are, which is 400,000 people across just about every country in the world. Pretty impressive to be able to do that.
Wes?
Yeah, I think dovetailing into the definition I gave on the previous question, I'm looking at, as you guys are probably well aware, with the new iOS, one of the big new features is that you can use other keyboards. And SwiftKey is the example I thought of with this question, which is, it basically is doing predictive typing for you based on natural language definitions and also the context in which you're typing the message. And of course, the complexity of that computation is being done in the cloud and not necessarily on your phone when that occurs. So that was an example I thought of.
Okay. And Larry?
Not very sexy, but a real estate development management company that we're working with is utilizing a cloud-based system that they're deploying to allow all connectivity and communication and collaboration among all the various properties around the United States that they're developing with their Manhattan, New York City headquarters.
Okay. And now again to the negative, where is the mobile cloud not performing acceptably? Or if you choose not to single out poor performance, where would you anticipate that mobile cloud would not work well, and why not? Sal?
So I would have an example of a class of things that I would say not yet, right? And that would be client data of any sort, but even that is changing. So, you know, a year and a half ago when we asked some of the engineering companies about putting their engineering data on the cloud, you know, they said, no way. No, not us. We asked them again the same question, you know, about 3-4 months ago, our board of advisors. And these are, you know, the very large engineering firms you'd all know. They said, maybe we would. So I think times are changing. So we have, you know, many clients for whom the public cloud, you know, putting a bank, for example, putting data into a cloud database on Bluemix, they would say, no, not for us, okay? Now, they could still access it through Cast Iron and keep the data where it is, but they would say, I won't store it in Cloudant today, okay? But roll forward and where this is going, you know, I can certainly see managed versions of those environments. I can certainly see the day when those environments become something that a client themselves could go and run and have a private cloud instance of that, right? So I think it's a not yet. And even the case of data, you know, like I said, I'm seeing changes in how people just in a span of about 15, 16 months thought about some of their engineering data and where they think now, right? So things are changing very quickly.
Wes?
Yeah, and my thought process on this is very similar to Sal's in the sense that I think it's not that it's not performing well, it's more that there's hesitancy to move in that direction. So a lot of the things we see is, and you can even tie it to cloud in general and not just mobile cloud, which is, you know, concerns about security or concerns about losing ownership of things. And I think everybody in this room has probably seen that there are many different ways where we progress as an industry to achieve that better.
Larry.
I think where there's a connectivity challenge is one of the key challenges for mobile cloud to work. So the kinds of access that folks want, and the kinds of files, again, for a real estate developer, there may be CAD files, there may be contracts, there may be subdivision plats, and for people to get at that stuff with their tablets or smartphones or mobile devices boils down to kind of connectivity. So if you've got, and which, by the way, is a whole separate topic of discussion generally for cloud, but it is most pointed in the mobile arena where you're depending on LTE or 4G or the kind of connectivity that you can get to hook in. So that would be a challenge. And I apologize, I have to step away for 1 second. But
sure. We're not going to tie you down. Kaishi?
Oh, well, I think mobile cloud is perfect. But I think if I have to pick on some negative side, I think the from some of the projects, what I feel is that some people are creating a big data problems using devices and cloud instead of trying to figure out a big data solution using the devices and the cloud. So as you collect those a humongous amount of data, I guess the first thing you need to be sure that what kind of questions you are asking, what kind of intelligence you are trying to get. Otherwise, you are doing a lot of busy work to collecting all the data to reach out to all the devices, but you are not really benefiting your business overall.
Okay. Yeah. College Bound is a fascinating case study and a great example of cloud-based solutions positively impacting society in ways that perhaps we would not have expected. Are there other examples that you can point out of cloud computing deployments that have had a beneficial impact on humankind? Wes?
Yeah, you know, one example that comes to mind is Mercy Ships. They're an organization that, you know, as the name might imply, provides healthcare workers and caregivers on ships to hit areas that have been ill affected by disasters or poverty. And so, you know, to Larry's point, that is a connectivity nightmare with a lot of the items that they're dealing with. And we've seen a solution there where we used, again, the OutSystems platform to enable and simplify their onboarding of their resources that they have on board on the ships and join the ships. And we're able to incorporate and simplify their infrastructure in such a way that they were enabled with the lower power devices that they carry with them. And it's really helped save money, helped save time, and helped them deal better with the high turnover that they normally see.
Aishi?
Actually, I think the public safety example I mentioned was pretty good. But another example I can mention is that it's actually one of the projects I worked with. I worked with a bunch of elementary schools. What the system does is to allow the teachers to quickly note down the behaviors of the children, because in the elementary school, if a teacher is looking after tens of students, it's really hard for the teacher to actually monitor the exact behavior, especially for those children who has challenges to cope with the school environment. And what the system does is to have a tablet for the teacher, and the teacher can note down a behavioral data point by single click or a tap on the screen. Then later on in the same evening, the teacher can analyze the pattern of the students and adjust the curriculum and the education accordingly. I think that's a very small project, but it's been used in several elementary schools, and the result is pretty good.
Okay. Sal?
Yeah, the thing about these kind of platforms is that they allow you to be able to have a playground, right? Easily to be able to have people go work cooperatively. So with the coming of Bluemix within IBM, we've seen a lot of collaboration. We've held a number of hackathons, right, and focus people around, let's say, water, right, and give them data sets and focus on that. You know, we had one engineer in Ottawa. There's an organization called Shelterbox. They provide shelters, homes for places where there's disasters or, you know, refugee camps. And to be able to track those and provide that for Shelterbox, the organization. But it's what's exciting to me is that the amount of the price of entry for someone wanting to do this is so much lower, right, than it was before. You don't need that amount of infrastructure. You can work on your idea or your special gift yourself, and we've done a bunch of these, and it's really giving people. I give my team a day a month. The last Friday of every month is Hard Rock Wednesdays, and I want them to go experiment on and work on whatever project they want, build skills, and go do something good and have fun with the team.
And finally, when we look at the three verticals that are our special focus here at this conference, government and military, healthcare and life sciences, media and entertainment, in the future, what are the greatest challenges being brought to the way they do what they do by cloud computing? Larry's not here, okay, so we'll go to Aishi.
So actually, I haven't been working with government or healthcare customers. But I think what we are observing is that the cloud is actually transforming how the home entertainment is in our living rooms. For instance, the Azure has this successful broadcast of the recent Olympics. And in the recent Titanfall release, we actually use about 100,000 servers so that the players can have a really fluent and fair playing experience. So you can see The cloud is just not only for the business workload, but also is transforming how the people entertain themselves in their living rooms.
Sal, do you want to briefly add to that?
Sure. I think healthcare is one. Just a show of hands, anybody have a Fitbit or other wearable device? Okay, good. Good set of you, right? It is transformative, right? Whatever you do is pushed up to the cloud. You know, I got one for my wife and my two sister-in-laws, and, you know, I can shame them, right? I can taunt them. And this is just the very beginning. It's just steps, right? So you can begin to think about the kind of monitoring that will be added, that Fitbit and others, and for sure Apple, is adding into there. So I think that's one area that's going to be transformative. IBM actually gave its U.S. employees, I'm not one, but the option to get one this year. So there's a lot of IBMers with them, and I think it's a real great ROI on that. And I think this is one area that, and I'll put in a plug for Fitbit, if I'll add you as a friend of sorts as well.
Wes.
Well, I think tying into what we heard this morning from a government perspective also applies to healthcare and life sciences, which is that, you know, what would previously require multi-million dollars worth of supercomputers or computing clusters is now very affordable and able to get, as the example this morning, with a $40 credit card purchase. And so that's lowering the bar where more underfunded organizations now have the capacity to innovate and bring innovation that way.
Well, I'd like to thank all of our panelists up here. I appreciate your time very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.